In our study last time, I made mention of the fact that Romans 6, 7, and 8 easily divides into three sections. Romans 6 is about grace, and Romans 7 is about the law, and Romans 8 is about life by the Spirit. And we have come a third of the way through in terms of chapters, not in terms of content or length of content. Anyway, in our study last time, in our introduction to chapter 7, we looked at the first four verses, kind of going pretty quickly through, because the illustration that is given in verses 1, 2, and 3 is pretty easy to get. I mean, everybody that Paul wrote to would have had no problem at all with taking the illustration of the way the law has jurisdiction over a person in a marriage covenant setting, where it would say one thing to the individuals in the covenant setting, but it would have nothing really to say to them if that covenant was broken by death. So that if a woman was married to a man and she joined herself to another man, the law would label her with that big A as adulteress, and she would be stigmatized and brought under condemnation and judgment for adultery under law. But if her husband died and she did exactly the same thing she'd done before in terms of joining herself to another man, the law was absolutely had nothing to say. She could join herself to another man and the law wouldn't condemn her at all. So the issue is the limited jurisdiction that law has, and it's a fundamental principle for the whole chapter because it's pretty clear from the emphasis that Paul talks about in the opening verse, that he is speaking to people who know law, but they don't know something very fundamental about it. And that is this limited jurisdiction issue, which he had already addressed in chapter 6 when he said that they were under grace and not under law. That's an easy concept to give lip service to. But because Paul had to write a whole chapter on relating to the issue of law in the relational universe, where your relationship with God and with other people is the issue of all of life, apparently it's really not easy to get out from under a legal mindset. And it really isn't. Just an enormous amount of grace preaching is hypocritical simply because the words are right, but the behavior that follows up the words is very legal. And that's just the contradiction in reality to theology. So the whole issue there was he wants to establish the fact that there is an area of ignorance that apparently is very profound and needs a lot of careful, prayerful submission in order to overcome. And yet there is another thing that I think is crucial to the whole chapter, and that is that this opening illustration of a wife and a husband and offspring, which are the fruit of the unity of the two into one, is an analogy for Paul's understanding of the way we are internally. There is apparently a male aspect of our makeup, and there is a female aspect of our makeup, and there is production out of the members of the body and behavior that's called fruit. The equivalent of children in the analogy. So we have to go into the chapter understanding that Paul is going to be dealing with some things that are, I don't think, well understood in Christianity. Most people just don't realize what he's saying in chapter 7, and as a consequence, the church is very legal in its orientation, so much so that I've heard people deliberately try to make justification by grace, apart from works of law, the only area where grace is really the issue. Because the same person who says justification is by grace, apart from law, will then turn right around and say that sanctification is a merited relationship. You can't have merit and grace, so I guess sanctification is a graceless thing in that orientation. And that's from somebody that studied the Bible lots and preached lots and taught lots. So you wonder. Well, I think it's pretty clear from the fact that he introduces this ignorance issue as a subtle blindness, that that's what this chapter is going to try to eliminate. So this evening we're going to look at verses 5 and 6 in this opening paragraph. He talks about, in verse 5, our former status in the flesh and how the law was in some way at the root of sinful behavior. And then the new status that we have in verse 6, where we have been, and the word translated released there is actually the word demolished. And what he's saying is we have been demolished from the law. In other words, the law has absolutely nothing it can do to touch us, because we have been completely, in its eyes, demolished, so that there's nothing there to say. And he says we were bound, but then we were released from that bondage so that we can serve in what he calls newness of the spirit and not in oldness of the letter. The definite articles, thee and before spirit and thee and the before letter in the translation are not there. Newness of spirit, not in oldness of letter. So that's where we're going this evening, is to look at these two issues of how this principle that law is limited to its specific applications has to do with us, because he's going to apply it in verse 5. 4, on the basis of verse 1 to 4, the fact that we have been, a part of us at least, has been put to death, being crucified together with Christ. Paul identified that part in chapter 6 as our old man was crucified together with him. And yet at the same time he says we were baptized into his death, so that we died in him, we were buried in him, we were raised in him, and we live in this new realm of living in him. So at least the thing he called the old man, that part of us that's male, was crucified together with Christ. That put him to death. That means that the woman is now free. The female part of us is now free to be joined to him that was raised from the dead. That's what verse 4 is actually saying. So that we're joined to a new man, and this new man plus us produces new children. That is, different kind of behavior. We can bear fruit for God. And then in that light, he says, four. In other words, I'm going to explain this. He says, when we were in the flesh, and he's not talking there about being in the body as a fleshly component of our makeup, because we are not were in that case. We are still in our physical fleshly bodies. So he can't be talking about our bodies when he says we were in the flesh. He has to be talking about flesh in a sense that has preceded us in our understanding in Romans. And the issue of being in the flesh with this dominion of sinful passions and law being imposed and at work in the members of our body to bear fruit to death, that has to have something to do with chapter 5 and our being constituted sinners by Adam's sin, and chapter 6, how that whole identity thing has been shattered because now we're in Christ and not in Adam any longer. And so we have a new identity, a new reality, a new relationship, and all of that. So the flesh, apparently, is simply the natural state that comes in every person's situation by their generation from their parents. When a person is conceived and then born and begins to function, they're doing so with attributes and capacities, resources that are passed on by natural generation from generation to generation. So human beings are reproducing themselves in their children, and because the only thing they can reproduce in their children of themselves is what they were, are, by natural generation. So being in the flesh simply means we didn't have any of the attributes or resources necessary to live godly. We were in the flesh. We were in this natural state produced by bodies of flesh that reproduce themselves while they are being slaves of the sin. Even believers who are no longer slaves of the sin still cannot generate children who take on their new identity status by natural generation. It's not passed on that way. You don't get from generation to regeneration simply because your parents believe. Though there is a prejudice, the scriptures are clear about the fact that the children, the offspring of believers, are in some ways sanctified by their parents' decisions. It's not an actual regeneration condition, but it is a sanctifying setting. You're different from the person whose parents were unbelievers when you were generated and born and lived. There's a sanctifying element there that Paul used in 1 Corinthians to caution a believer who's married to an unbeliever to stay in that relationship, because that's the believer sanctifies the spouse and the children in that setting. And if the unbeliever departs, then the sanctification departs with him or her. And that leaves the unbelieving spouse and the unbelieving children without this sanctifying influence. So there is that little area of prejudicial influence, but it doesn't say anywhere in the scriptures, it never says that children are regenerated by natural generation. They are only regenerated by personal faith in Christ as the Savior. So he's just talking about being in the flesh. He's talking about natural reality before salvation occurs. He says, when that was the case, when we were in that natural setting, there was this thing called sinful passions. And before we talk about being, as the New American Standard, being aroused by the law, let's just think about sinful passions for a minute. The issue of sinful passions has to have a reference backwards to the sin, because that's where this whole problem began. That's where natural generation got its death impact on all of humanity. So we can say that the natural passions, or the sinful passions, literally passions of the sins, it has something to do with the two issues that we talked about in chapter 6. The fear of death, which makes men self-focused in a self-preservation kind of way, which completely cuts off the issue of love from their motivation. You can't be self-centered and loving simultaneously in a biblical sense of loving. So if a person is under the fear of death, the whole idea there is that he's very much interested in preserving his physical life, and as long as that's his mindset, he cannot act in a loving way. He has to act in a self-serving way, and that would make all of his behavior evil. And not only that, but in conjunction with Adam's sin, when Adam became self-focused and took the bite of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, he capitulated to the tempter in a way that allowed a different spirit to become the dominant force in human behavior. And I really believe that that's the issue that really makes Adam constituting us sinners, so that we're sinners from birth and then on. It's the spirit that makes that the reality. And it's called in Ephesians 2 the spirit that works in the sons of the disbelief. So those who are affected by Adam's disbelief are now under a spiritual bondage that creates all kinds of issues. So when we talk about the fear of death and the spirit that's at work in the sons of the disbelief, both of those factors will produce all manner of evil. The offspring of those two issues in man will produce evil continuously, because he's self-serving in his fear of death, and he is evil spirit-serving in his behavior, because it's the spirit that motivates the energy or the activities of the members of the body. So that boils down to a dominant commitment to self-preservation at all levels of the human constitution. And what I mean by all levels is body, soul, and spirit. The body is fundamentally interested in self-preservation. That's why you have the fight and flight automatic reaction as soon as there's anything that could be interpreted by the physical frame as a fearful thing. That's why if you hear a loud bang or a loud noise, you're immediately arrested and you're immediately motivated to see what that was, to see if you need to take any kind of defensive action. That's fight or flight. It's built into the adrenal system. You just are automatically shot with adrenaline as soon as this possibly fearful thing occurs. That's the body at work, and it's self-preservation. On the other hand, the soul is completely relational in a very real sense. It has to do with the idea of security being achieved by having enough friends and people around you who care about your best interests, if there are any who care. But nonetheless, that's the only way you can actually feel any sense of security. You can lay down and sleep because nobody's trying to kill you, or if somebody is trying to kill you, you've got somebody who cares enough about you that they'll see that you're not killed while you're sleeping. That's the only way you get any rest. Well, that's the soul in what I call relational self-preservation. It's just interested in staying alive relationally. And then the spirit has this issue, this fixation on having a good reputation in the eyes of men, and it takes any threat to that as a serious issue, doesn't want to be humiliated, doesn't want to be embarrassed, doesn't want to have to do anything that would cause anybody to think badly of them. That's the primary reason people are afraid to stand up and talk in a group, is because they're afraid of what people will think, especially if they're not skilled in talking in front of people or whatever, and nobody starts out that way. But nonetheless, that's just an example of how fearful we are of being humiliated. And that's just the spirit functioning in a self-preservation in the terms of reputation. All of these body, soul, spirit, self-preservation fixations are most fundamentally invested in their own agendas. So the body has an agenda, the soul has an agenda, and the spirit has an agenda. And here is the reason why we have the word passions. Because the word translated passions is most often in the scriptures translated sufferings. And the whole idea is that there is something that you're suffering, which means you're being subjected to some things that you would prefer not to be subjected to. That's what suffering is. It's being subjected to either pain or relational conflicts or humiliation or humiliating circumstances. Like having a tape surface 15 years after you've made a fool of yourself or something along that line. Nobody wants that to happen. But the body says, just make me comfortable. The soul says, just make me secure. And the spirit says, just make me have a good reputation. Well, those three agendas are often mutually exclusive. There are certain times when the body's desire for comfort will be in direct conflict with the spirit's desire for a good reputation and the soul's desire for a good relationship. Whenever that happens, you are now subject to suffering because there's this conflict inside where this agenda is in direct opposition to this one and this one. And you multiply that. There are basically three ways you can be all messed up inside, and then there are shades of mixtures of those that are just like the colors that flow out of three basic primary colors. It's just an enormous number of ways that you can be disturbed within. That's the suffering. And he talks about the sufferings that are of the sins. That has to do with the sins of the body being fixated on self-preservation, the sins of the soul being fixated on relational preservation, and the sins of the spirit being fixed on maintaining a good reputation no matter what. Well, these create inner conflicts. And the sins that are driving these motivational things are in competition and wrestling with one another. The agendas are in conflict. So the spirit's wrestling with the body and the soul and so on. This is where the struggle gets to be often fierce. And it is driven very powerfully at very fundamental levels. If the body is actually under the threat of physical death, it will, more times than not, overrule the soul and spirit. It will insist that the spirit do something to preserve the physical life of the body. And it will insist with such insistence that it will just overrule. And so a person who reputationally doesn't want to be known as a coward will often, when faced with the threat of imminent death, wet his pants and run. Two things that people just don't want anybody to know they ever did. Why? Because of their reputation. It has nothing to do with the physical body directly. It just has to do with reputation. But the physical body made it happen. And in the same way, if a relationship is cratering or falling apart, there's enormous relational pain. Oftentimes, the person will not eat, or they will eat way too much of foods that are what they call comfort foods, and the soul will actually destroy the body in its pain because it's overruling the body in its real needs. And often the same thing will happen in the spirit realm. The reputation of the individual will be shoved aside because of the relational sufferings, and the same thing with the spirit. If there's actually a situation where the person is going to be super humiliated, sometimes the threat of super humiliation will actually cause the person to sacrifice his body and or his soul just to keep from being looked at in a bad way. These are what Paul calls the sinful passions. These are the driving motivations that are driven by the internal conflicts of three different areas of conflict and agenda. Eventually, in every setting, one of these elements of man gains dominion. And that motivates the members of the body to take actions along the lines of its own interests. And that's why Paul talks about the difference between being dead to the law so that your members can be used by God to do the righteous things, or being in bondage to the law so that sin can use your members to produce wicked things. That's what he's driving at. And he says, in the flesh, that's the condition. You can't escape the physical pains and threats. You can't escape the relational conflicts and disintegrations. You can't escape the humiliations and all that. That's the condition of humanity. That's why the world's in all the mess it's in. And then he makes this statement. These sinful passions were by the law. And the word arouse is not in the text. It just says these were by the law. And the question is, in what sense were they by the law? That's the issue. What does the law really have to say in this situation? And what is it that causes verse 7 to open up with this statement? What shall we say then? Is the law sin? So we have to be careful in understanding of verse 5. But he actually says that these sinful passions are irritated, aggravated, and motivated by the presence of law. So we need to understand what's actually being said there. The real issue is that we are subject to these internal conflicts, these competitions of agendas that are fighting among themselves for dominance. And it's a major problem, partly because of law. Because the law stands over the conflicts with judgments about the evil that is driving these conflicts. In other words, the law condemns the conflicts. It condemns the body for being selfish. It condemns the soul for being selfish. It condemns the spirit for being selfish, so that the function of the law is condemnation. It just judges these things as wrong, wrong, wrong. So in that sense, the function of law is a detrimental function, because each part of us, body, soul, and spirit, is intensely self-centered, and the law condemns anything and everything that arises in actions from the members of the body that is driven by loveless self-preservation. It's intensely evil. If you take, as I made the comment earlier before the study, the greatest commandment is to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That's the greatest commandment. That means that not doing it is the greatest evil. So the law stands in judgment over lovelessness as the greatest evil that a person can do. And given that reality, that exacerbates the problem of self-preservation because it makes every self-preservation action evil and thus becomes a potent threat to preservation at any level. If the law says, body, you're being selfish, then the body is under more threat of death than it ever has been because the law is condemning it. The condemnation of the law may be death. The soul that sins shall die. The body that sins shall die. The spirit that sins shall die. So the law stands as a goad, in a sense, condemning every evil action. Is judged by the law as an evil thing, and since there are no righteous actions, they're all evil, it just makes man either fall into despair and rage against the unfairness of being demanded of things that you can't do, or it builds a blindness that causes the person to say, I'm not guilty of that, I'm not guilty of that, I'm not guilty, and self-righteousness arises, and then the arrogance and the pride just blossoms. So, that's all because the law stands over this saying, sinner, sinner, sinner. There's no escape. It's just hammer, hammer, hammer. So, if there were no law there doing that, then an enormous amount of the conflict would die away. So, with law present, there's no escape at any level. All selfishness is evil and therefore subject to the condemnation of law. And the law's consequent execution of its judgment. If the law says that was evil and the wages of sin is death, then... So that's how the law is a goad. The sinful passions are actually goaded by the law, and that makes them energize. The words were at work, it's energize the members of our body to bear fruit for death. We're energized by either the condemnation and despair, or we're energized by the condemnation being denied in self-righteousness. In both cases, there's an immense hostility toward this condemning voice of law. That's the way it was. Before we came to know Christ, when we were in the flesh, that's the situation we were facing. Constantly wrong. Fighting constantly, trying to keep the wrong from killing us at any level. But now, verse 6, we have been released, destroyed from the law. We have been freed by reason of three particular things. One is substitution. That's chapter 6, where Christ takes on our identity for us in our place, so that we by faith can become in Him as a substitute. He goes to all of the condemnation of the law, every dreg, every bit of the condemnation of the law, He goes under as our substitute, as a sinner. And He bears there as a sinner all of the condemnation of law against us. Having done that, He rises from the dead and enables us to be declared righteous by God by faith. And once the declaration of justification has occurred, the law has nothing to say to us. So by substitution, through our identity with Christ as a substitute, we are absolutely righteous, incapable of being condemned by law, and therefore all this inner conflict is addressed by the fact that the law is no longer condemning us. Now, that may not actually change the internal conflict thing, but it erases the condemnation and the judgment to come, which diminishes the level of fear. And it addresses that evil spirit of the sons of disbelief because it declares that what the disbelief is rooted in is not true. But that brings us to the second thing. We're free by reason of substitution, Christ taking our place, But we're also free by promise, because the promise is a promise of eternal life at every level. That's why physical resurrection from the dead is included in the promise. The body has an eternal living future, which means the body doesn't have to be afraid of being put to death. Its mortality is erased as a problem for those who believe in the promise. By the same token, the relational issue is rooted fundamentally in God's relationship with us, where He says, I will never leave you nor forsake you, and therefore the soul can never be subject to death in any final sense, because it's united with God and He'll never leave. And at the spirit level, there is no threat of condemnation and God just tossing you away because you're worthless. That would be the ultimate humiliation. And because He's not going to do that, there's nothing in the spirit that drives the spirit to preserve itself. So by promise, we're delivered from the need for self-preservation and all the wickedness that that produces. We can offer our bodies as a sacrifice. We can offer our souls as a sacrifice. We can offer our spirits as a sacrifice, because in the final analysis, there's resurrection that is going to erase all the sacrifice. So by promise, we're delivered. And then by actual provision, we're delivered. Because he talks about we are serving in newness of spirit. That's not an accident that he says that. There is a spirit that works in the sons of the disbelief. And there is given by God to us a new spirit that works in the sons of faith. So by the Spirit of God, which is what the New Testament identifies this new spirit as, He gives us the impetus to actually yield our members, the members of our body, as instruments to God for the production of real righteousness in a real world. And given that kind of provision, we are delivered from any kind of condemnation from law, simply because the law doesn't condemn the righteous. It doesn't condemn righteous acts as evil. If the Spirit of God is producing righteous behavior, the law has nothing to say to us. If we're not motivated to evil by unbelief, if the promise is fixed in our minds, we're not motivated to do anything that the law would condemn. And besides that, it can't condemn us because we're in Christ. So by substitution, promise, and provision, we're free from the law. And that means that we have been, as he says, demolished from the law. The wording is awkward, but it's intense, because it says, because we have been demolished from the law has absolutely no ability to visit its judgments upon us. We are absolutely free from law. We have been demolished from the law, and then he explains it, having died to that by which we were bound. This death is the thing that held us under law. The mechanism of freedom is death. By death, we are set free. That's most graphically illustrated by the fact that when your physical body dies, and then it's physically resurrected from the dead, there's no carryover. When the body died, all of the wicked, evil issues of the body died with it. And when it's raised immortal, which means it's perfectly righteous and incapable of dying. So we're free. The mechanism of this freedom is actually death. And he says, our death, we died to that by which we were bound. And in the illustration of verses 1 to 3, our death was that male part of us that was under the dominion of the spirit that produced all kinds of unbelieving evil. That element or aspect of us died with Christ. So we died in that regard to the law by which we were bound. And therefore, the law has nothing to say to dead people. Nothing. It's an absolute freedom. Because our death was a death to law's realm of dominion. And that's what verses 1, 2, and 3 are talking about. The realm of dominion. The law can only speak to certain circumstances in certain settings. And if those circumstances and settings change, then the law has nothing more to say. Well, our circumstances and setting has changed significantly, and the law has nothing more to say. So, the outcome is we are able to serve in newness of spirit and not in oldness of letter. And the issue there is so that we serve. In other words, that's the word for being a slave. The issue is in freedom is never the ability to be a little g god without obligations in any realm. Do as you please, whatever. That's not freedom. Freedom is the ability to act in harmony with truth and love. And that kind of freedom is only ours because we have a new spirit. We are slaves to somebody, and it was a slavery to the sin, but now it's a slave relationship to the Spirit of God. And given that, we have this freedom to function by a new spirit, walking by the Spirit of God. And because of that, we have been removed from what he called oldness of letter. And all that means is the law was recorded in letters, which turned into words, which turned into sentences, which turned into paragraphs, which turned into all kinds of stuff, covered extensively in 1,500 years of Jewish history and prophet and law. The prophets were extremely condemnatory because they preached law. And their basis for their preaching was the written record from God. And we have been delivered from what he calls oldness of letter. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means this. Words record accurate truth, but they provide no power for the individual. That was the law. It declared the holiness of God. It declared the attributes of his righteousness and his justice and all of the things that were true about God. And it, on the basis of those truths, it made certain commands to men in relating to this just God. But it gave them nothing to empower it. And it was given to them while they were in the flesh, which meant that it wasn't going to help them in a direct way. Now, Paul said in Galatians that the law does help in a significant way as a tutor to bring us to Christ. But the tutorship of the law is basically condemnation until you absolutely cannot see any way out. And so you cry out for a different method of approach. That's the whole point of the law. It's to drive us to Christ. As long as we rely on commandments given and actions taken on our part to try to meet those, we're hopeless. We have to come to Christ. First for regeneration and then for indwelling presence. That makes us free. We can actually serve God with the members of our bodies in newness of a new spirit and not in the oldness of a law that made demands and gave no power. So I really think that what's going on in verses 5 and 6 is he's simply applying the first four verses. He's actually saying we were in a circumstance and situation that the law had much to say about. It was all condemnation. But now our circumstances and setting has changed. Now we are released from the law. We died to that which we were held by, and we serve in a new way, a new spirit. So that opens the door. That's the first paragraph. The very next question, as I've already mentioned in verse 7, is going to be, well, should we consider the law an evil thing then? Is it sinful? And of course the answer can't. It can't be. It's impossible. But how is it impossible? That's what we'll look at in the days and weeks to come if we're given the freedom to do that.